The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 351, A Gigantic Moral Blind Spot, Mormon Culture as a Gun Culture, by Ronald Mullen, with comments by Tom McAfee.
A Gigantic Moral Blind Spot. The moral issue of... Everybody here okay? The moral issue of firearms as it relates to the gospel has never been resolved in the LDS Church. The result is a gigantic blind spot in the Mormon culture and a society suffering from its repercussions. How extraordinary for a religion whose founding prophet was shot and killed by an angry mob, and with a legacy of retaliation in the Mountain Meadows Massacre that tarnished the church's image for decades. Both are examples of a gun culture gone awry. By 1890, the LDS Church was a well-established fundamentalist religion with an agenda that included polygamy, racism, and a gun culture. The church quickly set polygamy aside, eventually gave the Negro the priesthood, and moved in the direction of mainstream Christianity, Christian churches, yet the gun culture remained, and one wonders why. Hunting, marksmanship, and gun collecting are not part of the issue. A gun culture is a radical agenda where guns have deep symbolic meaning. A gun culture flippantly disregards a scandalous number of gun deaths each year and stresses gun rights over responsibility. Adherents find guns indispensable for daily living and use firearms to solve problems. Any effort to require gun safety, gun management, and gun control laws are vehemently fought. A gun culture includes otherwise decent men who are afflicted with a monumental myopia and who fail miserably the role of protecting the young. The phenomena of a gun culture does not exist in any other advanced nation, and that is true of most third world nations. Utah exhibits the tragic characteristics of a gun culture, with guns in the schools, drive-by shootings, armed militias in the foothills, a high teenage suicide rate. Utah is sixth in the nation. Last year it was fifth. It goes back and forth. All 10 of the worst states are Western states. A high rate of homicide resulting from domestic violence, a scandalous number of children shot and killed in gun accidents, 17,000 citizens armed with concealed weapons wandering the streets, and a legislature that is completely blind to the carnage. Again, these conditions do not exist in other advanced nations. Utah is a dangerous place to live and raise children. A child in the United States is 12 times more vulnerable to a gun-related death than a child in other advanced nations. And Utah is one of the worst places in this gun-violent land. Hardly a pretty picture for a religious state. The frontier tradition of rugged individualism could be held responsible for the gun culture so prevalent in all Western states. Yet the Mormon culture was unique in its focus on community and cooperation. Guns were only needed for food, for the food hunting could provide. Somehow distrust of government and other concerns of the West locked many Mormons into the gun culture. Although tenets of the gun culture are never preached in church, there is a prevailing acceptance of the need to be armed. This is particularly true for members of the priesthood, and the Utah legislature is a good example of the Mormon priesthood in action. If the legislature were controlled by the Relief Society and the PTA, strict gun control laws would already be in place. The gun culture is a male phenomenon. Members are, for the most part, male, Mormon, anti-government, Republican, although some Democrats are included, sexist, homophobic, and are often members of the National Rifle Association. The most radical are available at a moment's notice to rush to the legislature and rally against any gun legislation, regardless of its merit. The Republican Mormon legislature, with the exception of a few women and men, is unfortunately a pushover. Despite the majority of people in the state, including the PTA, UEA, Utah Medical Association, virtually all mainline Christian churches, and a host of other organizations who favor gun control laws. The three most powerful organizations in the state are the LDS Church, the Republican Party, and the NRA. All three succeeded getting much of what they want. No utility company, corporation, or organization enjoys this kind of power. LDS equal GOP equal NRA. The LDS Church has no connection with the NRA, but the connection with the GOP is undeniable, and the connection with the GOP and NRA is openly admitted. The NRA is a front organization for small arms manufacturers both here and abroad. The NRA recently applied for GNO rating at the United Nations, where official recognition is required for all lobbying organizations. The NRA is therefore an international political action organization well funded by gun manufacturers. The goal of every citizen armed, it claims, will produce a polite society. Hardly the kingdom of God in a promised land. It also promotes the concept that an armed citizenry is prepared to revolt when government no longer lives up to the NRA's interpretation of the Constitution. Government is what we do together, and armed power has no place in the honest debate required in a democracy. Unfortunately, the NRA is the organization that makes gun policy for Utah. The Republican legislature puts it into law, and the church remains silent, more concerned with issues of pornography and liquor. Several years ago, Bob Bennett admitted that it was impossible for a candidate to get out of the Republican state convention without endorsing the NRA. Merrill Cook confirmed that again this year. But this is hardly news. The Republican Party maintains the NRA can deliver 11% of the vote, and of course, it is generous with campaign money. GOP equal NRA. The GOP relationship with the NRA is scandalous and poisons the political atmosphere of the entire state. Our senators and representatives returned to Washington this January, hell-bent on repealing the assault weapons ban, never explaining why anyone needs weapons designed for the battlefield. Locally, the legislature passed a concealed weapons law that was much more permissive than the concealed weapons law in either Wyoming or Texas. I'm talking about, you know, redneck states, but anyway. And our governor, a close ally of the gun culture, signed it. Voinovich, the Republican governor of Ohio, not consistent with his party, promised to veto a similar bill. Citizens carrying a concealed weapon is viewed with amazement and profound revulsion by citizens of other advanced nations. Their gun laws are based on the Judeo-Christian ethic. Moses returned from the mountain with the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." Yet here in Utah, the gospel is sidestepped, guns control, and we pay a terrible price in gun-related deaths. Here is the very heart of moral blindness. Guns are a technology for killing, and handguns are designed specifically for killing human beings. Shouldn't their use be prescribed by moral teachings and reflected in laws? The church has demanded liquor control and pornography control. Why not gun control? Almost every major Christian church favors some form of gun control. The Episcopalian Church has even sponsored national seminars and rallies. Utah's Episcopalian bishop, ironically a woman raised as a Mormon, provides a marvelous example of moral leadership on the issue. The only statement from the church thus far was a cautious request that concealed weapons not be allowed in church. Although helpful, this does not begin to address the problem. nor does it begin to address the moral issue of guns. President Bateman of BYU gave a speech claiming moral relativism was responsible for the recent moral decline in society. On the gun issue, the Mormon culture has moved beyond moral relativism to moral blindness. Paradoxically, two little boys in Utah County shot their sisters in the head while the local moral outrage focused on the rental of adult movies from a video shop. Little boys do not shoot their sisters in the head in other advanced nations. Handguns are simply not available. We are taught to love our neighbor, even turn the other cheek, but how can that be applied in a gun culture? Particularly since guns raise the stakes of every encounter. Individuals who go through the special training required for a concealed weapons permit are taught to shoot to kill, otherwise the gun would be used against them, which begs the question, what would Christ say about carrying a concealed weapon? What would he say about living daily, hourly, with a willingness to shoot to kill? What would he say about the need for an assault weapon? The church has nothing to gain from a gun culture. Guns have no place in the plan of salvation. The missionary's message should not be tarnished by the compromising existence of a gun culture involving many priesthood leaders, seminary teachers, members of the tabernacle choir, even temple workers. Listen to the words of a hymn the gun culture turns into a lie. High on a mountain top, a banner is unfurled. Ye nations now look up, it waves to all the world. In Deseret, sweet peaceful land, on Zion's mount, behold it stands. Nations look down on a gun culture that violates moral values and common sense. And Deseret is hardly a sweet, peaceful land. Certainly not a secure enough place to host the Winter Olympics. Polygamy and racism were public relations disasters for the church that took years to overcome. The gun culture can only do irreparable harm. If the church is to become a world church, it must act like one. The only true church can hardly take a message to the world when its moral standards are in any way compromised by a gun culture. The church is much better than the gun culture would allow. Wallace Stegner insisted the myth of the cowboy conquering the West was a lie. The cowboy was a loner, a wanderer. The real settling of the West was accomplished through community, cooperation, the very elements responsible for the Mormon success. The gun culture exemplifies the cowboy, the loner who crouches behind locked doors, gun in hand, waiting for the world to end. If there is a threat to public safety, we should attack the problem, as Mormons always have, through community and cooperation. An article of faith states that government should be respected. We should demand a responsible police force, then be willing to work with it to secure our community. A neighborhood watch can do more to increase security than any number of armed vigilantes with concealed weapons. Canada sets an excellent example with a shared frontier tradition and a similar number of hunters, marksmen, and gun collectors. Absent, of course, is the NRA, and gun owners have been willing to balance gun rights with responsibility and back well-conceived gun laws. Handguns are tightly controlled like they are in all advanced nations. Canada is a much safer and saner place to live. Back in the 50s, the number of shooting deaths in Utah during the deer hunt averaged around 20 per season. I'd just like to say I was raised a Mormon just outside of Chicago, and I came here in 1953, and I could not believe what happened during the deer hunting season. So, I was the out-of-towner that didn't grow up with getting used to it. In 1967, a law was passed that required all young hunters to take gun safety course. Gun deaths dropped precipitously, and today the average is around one or two, so a drop from 20 to one or two. Who could have predicted a gun control law could have been that successful? Intelligent, well-crafted gun control laws work. Statistically, it is now safer to go deer hunting than to stay in the city where gun deaths proliferate. Fortunately, that gun safety training law was passed before the NRA was taken over in 1972 by a group of radicals backed by the gun manufacturers. Today, it is impossible to pass any meaningful gun legislation in the state. Again, GOP equal NRA. We should do whatever it takes to reduce the scandalous number of deaths relating to firearms. 38,000 die each year in this country, and by the year 2000, it is projected that number will exceed auto-related deaths, which is around 43,000. We lose close to one young person a week in Utah. You ought to talk to the doctors at the emergency room at Primary Children's Hospital. A law requiring all firearms be locked up while the adult owner is away from home could reduce that rate significantly. The church has an obligation to speak out on this moral issue. If the merchants of pornography had taken over the state like the gun manufacturers have, the matter would have been settled long ago and hundreds of lives might have been saved. The church should lead the way to a saner, safer society. Responsible gun owners should step forward and assist in this effort. Canadian gun owners do not live in fear of having their guns confiscated. Only in a gun culture where gun rights are out of balance with gun responsibility does that fear exist. We need laws that require gun safety training for all gun owners and gun lockup laws that would reduce adolescent suicides, gun accidents, and guns in the schools. Gun sales should be limited to licensed merchants, and certain weapons like handguns be restricted to those who are licensed, take special training, and have their weapons registered. Most important would be a change in attitude, a willingness to balance rights with responsibilities. Utah will only be a state worth emulating when there are no longer guns in the schools, militias in the hills, a disgraceful rate of teen suicide and accidental shootings, citizens running the streets with concealed weapons, and a legislature that will listen to doctors, teachers, gun victims, parents, and religious leaders instead of the NRA. In sum, when males again assume the responsibility of protecting the young. Utah is in the West, but should not be part of the Wild West. It should be a different place, a better place. If it is not, the church is irrelevant. Where there is no vision, the people perish. Thank you.
The gun regulation debate that's been going on really for the past 30 years but has intensified over the last decade is as important as it has been controversial, even if at times it seems to generate as much heat as light. For that reason, I'm almost regretful that we don't have a larger audience to talk about the subject, although I'm tempted to suggest that, this is what happens whenever you put, a topic that's rational and philosophical against one having to do with the violence inherent in the local culture. And, of course, most people, for that very reason, went to see the discussion of Gail Houston's firing at BYU. Just goes to show that, some kinds of violence interest people more than others. I suspect, a rather unlikely defender of the local gun culture, especially as Ron defines it. Though I was raised as a Mormon in Utah, and my dad has some of the craziest deer hunting stories you ever wanted to hear. I have lived away from Utah virtually all of my adult life. I've never owned a firearm. In Ron's terms, it seems that he seems to link up with what he calls the local gun culture. I'm not conservative, Republican, a member of the NRA, homophobic, nor am I an active LDS priesthood holder, though I am Mormon and I have do hold the priesthood. Of course, I also don't look like Charlton Heston, who's had the unique privilege of speaking both for God as Moses, as well as for the NRA. But he couldn't be here, so they asked me to make a few comments. Ron's discussion of the Utah gun culture, when I actually got his paper and got, you know, beyond the brief description in an abstract, actually surprised me a little bit, in that when I think of Utah's gun culture, what I think of is hunting, target practicing, and gun collecting. As I think I've noted, my dad was a deer hunter and certainly an occasional target practicer, and I don't know if he's a gun collector, but he's got a pretty good collection of guns. But you'll notice that for Ron, the gun culture is defined primarily in terms of advocacy of gun rights, for what he calls gun rights over gun responsibility, and or for the employment of guns beyond these narrower purposes. I guess what leaves me a little bit taken back with that as a definition is that at that point, we hardly have a local gun culture at all, at least not a local gun culture that could distinguish itself from American culture generally in any significant way or manner. According to the national polls that I have seen, large majorities of Americans believe that they have a constitutional right to own a gun and keep one in their home for self-defense purposes and other purposes. And an even larger percentage believe that such a right, regardless of what the Second Amendment or other constitutional guarantees mean, to own a gun should be a legal right. That is actually in striking contrast, surprisingly enough, to what we might refer to as elite culture. I can speak to that question to some degree because I'm a law scholar and teacher, and I can tell you that until about the last 10 years, the amount of writing in law journals relating to the Second Amendment was practically nil, and for a number of different reasons, that scholarly discussion has gradually heated up. But what's reflected there, I think, is a real strong academic bias, really, about gun rights and about related sorts of themes. Former Chief Justice Warren Burger, who I think would hardly be viewed as a flaming liberal in most quarters, actually has made the claim that the NRA's promotion of the idea that people have a right to own guns because of the Second Amendment is some sort of a fraud that's been perpetrated on the American people. And on another occasion, and the two views may be more closely related than you might guess, he made the suggestion that if we were drafting the Constitution today, he was very confident that it would not include a Second Amendment. In any event, I tended to see Ron's paper as a reflection of one disappointed that Mormon culture maybe hasn't repudiated American culture in this sense, hasn't risen above this apparent national popular consensus, at least in favor of gun rights. One of the things that we're struggling around with here, of course, is problems also of definition. If you ask anyone if they're in favor of the environment, they're all going to say yes. Ask any member of the NRA if they are in favor of responsible gun legislation, you're not going to get a no answer to that. They're going to all say, yes, they favor responsible gun legislation and gun regulations. They do it all the time. Indeed, the example of gun safety courses required as a prerequisite to getting a hunting license strikes very close to home, in the sense that I remember taking one of those courses prior to obtaining a hunting license as a young person, I confess I quickly lost interest in hunting. My dad was the hunter and fisher. My mom took trips to San Francisco and stayed in high-rise hotels and went to Fisherman's Wharf. You can imagine which direction I might have gravitated toward. But the point is that really a great many people both in and out of the NRA will differ, but the NRA has always been a very strong proponent, for example, of the kinds of courses that we're talking about here. Indeed, I talked to a friend of mine this week after reading Ron's paper, and he told me that it was the NRA who actually conducted most of the courses that were offered throughout the state of Illinois, which is where I live. I didn't get a chance to check and see how the thing functions around here, but from its inception, the NRA has always sponsored gun safety courses and encouraged gun safety and gun safety programs, all of that kind of thing. I don't think there's any room for doubt that at some level there's some common ground here about balancing rights and responsibilities. The real serious question here, and the one that Ron's paper in some respects, it seems to me, strikes glancing blows at but doesn't quite exactly come to terms with, is the question of, is there or should there be any sort of right to have firearms for purposes other than hunting, recreation? I read an article not too long ago that in which someone had gotten frustrated at a comment by President Clinton, who actually said that he believed in the Second Amendment and he believed in protecting the rights of all hunters, and almost sounded as though he equated the two. And this was a very short article that was just entitled, Mr. President, the Second Amendment ain't about hunting. And the one thing I can absolutely guarantee you about, that no responsible scholarly voice has looked at the Second Amendment and come away with the conclusion that it has anything to do with hunting. That much is very clear. Now, the Second Amendment I've mentioned several times. You may have noticed that Ron did not. This actually is my backdoor entrance to the modern debate over gun control. My field of interest and expertise as a scholar is constitutional interpretation, and I have a strong interest in constitutional history. And the last few years, I've done some research on the Second Amendment, recently published a lengthy article on the history and meaning of the Second Amendment. I won't bore you with a lot of details about that, but I found it, in some respects, striking, and in one respect, almost disconcerting, that we would have a discussion of the underlying moral question without raising the Second Amendment. The reason that I put it this way is because it seems to me that when we're talking about the morality of public policy, that at least one aspect of that in a political system dedicated to social contract, the idea that we established a fundamental law as a people, that we're bound by that fundamental law. I've sat in Sunstone forums in the past in which on issues like pornography and others that Ron alluded to, the Constitution was invoked as an important factor to be considered. And it seems to me that at the very least, if one were to do work on the history and text of the Second Amendment and come to the conclusion that it indeed guarantees a personal right to have firearms, then it seems to me that at the very least, that of itself puts a very important imperative, at least in the hands of judges and legislators, some of the people that we've been talking about with respect to the local culture, in terms of what is my responsibility vis-a-vis that document. The original meaning of the Second Amendment is a matter of great controversy today, but this is one of those areas, like so many others, in which oftentimes our modern concerns and modern debates are sometimes seen as taking priority over the original meaning and intent. I won't try to address the original meaning of the Second Amendment for you. If you're interested in that topic, see me and I'll be happy to give you a reference or two. But one thing I'm absolutely certain about, and that is that apart from what the Second Amendment itself meant, there's absolutely no question that the founding generation was a gun culture in exactly the way that Ron defines it. In the Massachusetts Declaration of Rights, part of the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, it says that not only that we have the right to life, liberty, and property that some of you may recognize from such diverse sources as John Locke and Thomas Jefferson and many others, but they have the language that these rights include the right of defending their lives and property and protecting their lives and liberties and protecting their property. Samuel Adams, in the 1760s, as the tensions were mounting with England, referred to the right to defend these other rights, life, liberty, and property, in the best manner they can. There's not much question in my mind that the right of defense was not only seen as a right, it was seen as a duty and as the first law of human nature in the minds of the founding generation. Indeed, most of the religious ministers who defended the right of the colonies to resist what they, sharing the perspective of the colonists at least, viewed as tyranny on the part of the English government, continually contended that we had not only, again, a right, but a duty to resist that tyranny. This is part of the idea of having inalienable rights. I don't have the right to give up my freedom to you. At some point, I have a duty to resist. There's a statement that appears in several of the state constitutions, declarations of rights, documents that were passed on the immediate wake of revolution that said the doctrine of non-resistance is slavish and absurd. Okay. Now, that really brings me to, I might mention, by the way, that the alternative reading of the Second Amendment is one that emphasizes the rights of state militias, the rights of states to have militias. I just thought it was sort of interesting that if you were to, I don't know what Ron's position on the Second Amendment is, but the tendency of most gun regulatory advocacy groups has been to say that the Second Amendment does not guarantee any personal right to have arms, which makes the scope of gun regulation much less potentially problematic. So it's an understandable position to take. And so their tendency is to say that it has to do with the right of militias. I just mentioned this in passing because I thought it was interesting that Ron mentions the assassination of Joseph Smith, which was done by a militia that had been in training. And when they disbanded, they said, let's go over and kill Joe Smith. And the massacres, both at Hans Mill, that is perhaps worthy of mention as well, along with Mountain Meadows, were both performed as well by local militias. I mention this only because it seems to me that one aspect of the debate here has to do not only with the morality of self-defense and resistance, it's partly a matter of balancing public and governmental power versus private power, or at least that's how the framers would have seen it. And it strikes me that that's not anything that will ever go away in terms of relevance. For many people in this country, it is not a surprise that it is in the attempt to enforce gun regulations that we wind up producing events like Ruby Ridge. That one of the issues here does have to do with the potential for the abuse of power. If that's a problem at all in this country, the question of gun rights as it relates to many other countries where the ability to trust local law enforcement is extremely doubtful becomes a very serious issue. And the question of the relationship between state monopoly of the means of the use of force versus private use of force is a very delicate one, it seems to me, that's worthy of more exploration, for which we probably don't have time. Now, I guess the other thing that concerned me in Ron's paper is, again, some tension here between some expressions of viewpoint that would give even someone who's not a paranoid member of the NRA some pause for concern. For example, when he says that other nations' gun laws are based on the scriptural injunction, thou shalt not kill, and emphasizes that handguns, for example, are a technology based on killing humans. And there's a suggestion in his paper that then this ought to lead us to prescription in morality and law. This sounds to me like a potentially fairly complete argument for a total ban on handguns or other weapons, perhaps on all firearms except by government officials. Ron suggests that it's paranoia to think that's the goal of national efforts to regulate guns, and yet there are spokesmen in that movement, which it may not be unfair to mention given that the NRA has taken such a beating here, who have advocated precisely that all of the steps taken to this point, the Brady Bill, et cetera, are all at most ways of making inroads on a national gun culture, ways of setting up, you know, the right kind of mindset so that eventually we can get around to doing the rational and sane thing, which is getting rid of guns altogether. Taken literally, these particular statements by Ron really sound like an argument from a position of pacifism, and yet I found myself not persuaded that that's the argument he was actually entirely making. If he was, and this is just in a way another reason to think he wasn't, it seems to me that the Old Testament injunction against killing would be misplaced, because it's not a text at all that relates to pacifism, in my view at least. And I think the language scholars have made it pretty clear that it was generally understood that the word kill in Thou Shalt Not Kill referenced murder as we've traditionally understood it, and certainly would not have had any reference at all to self-defense. Certainly that is the burden and weight of all the scriptures recognized within Mormon culture, and I think receives some support in both the Old and New Testament, as well as in, and I think the predominant view down through history, though certainly not the exclusive one, among Christian thinkers, is that there is room in this world for self-defense, that the prevention of the wanton taking of human life, even if it means the tragic taking of human life, is nevertheless justified morally and spiritually. The sense I have, considering that it appears that he supports other nations' approaches, which involves putting a near monopoly in firearms in the hands of law enforcement, and emphasizes supporting law enforcement, and considering also that that he emphasizes ideas of a collective action and similar kinds of measures, the sense I have is that what he's really talking about here is a fear that a culture in which gun ownership and possession as the primary means of self-defense is one in which the misuse of guns becomes inevitable and becomes a problem of tragic misuse. But that's something I admit I have to kind of read between the lines. In any event, whether that's his exclusive position or not, it seems as though the heart of his position, as I took most of the paper, was an objection that guns kill people and that therefore it is selfishness to insist upon the right of guns to defend oneself with at the cost of a net loss in security against violence for all of us. In other words, if we produce a much more violent society because we're all walking around with guns, then maybe one of the things we have to give up to civil society is the right to the most effective means of self-defense, namely that of firearms. That strikes me as at least a very plausible argument, and it certainly is one that has been commonly advanced in the last 30 years. Whether the evidence really bears that out. For Ron, it appears that it's not a debate that has to be taken up, because for him it's enough to cite the statistics. We have a lot of guns in this society. We have a lot of suicides. We have a lot of murders. We have a lot of accidents. And, well, those things are obviously all connected. This has been an assumption in many quarters for many years, but there's a lot of reasons to call it into question. For example, he mentions Utah's high minor suicide rate. What I found interesting and striking about that is that over the years, the most common bit of evidence that's been used for the proposition that guns produce violence has always been that America has higher gun rates of ownership by far and away than other civilized countries, and other civilized countries have much lower murder rates, especially England and Western Europe. Well, so it must be because we have a lot more guns. The difficulty with that is that the folks who have propounded those statistics have always left out suicide. You might want to know why. Well, the reason's pretty clear, and that is because in other civilized nations, and this includes Japan, Western Europe, it includes Canada, where and particularly in Scandinavia and Japan, where you have very restrictive gun laws, You also have among the highest suicide rates in the world, much higher suicide rates than the United States. If there was this kind of correlation between gun ownership and violence, one would have expected that the violent act of suicide, just like murder rates, would also be higher in those places. In fact, if you put together for the last 30 years murder rates and suicide rates and put them on a single table, you come to find out that the United States ranks right in the middle in terms of the civilized world. Another fact that tends to raise interesting questions about all of this is that there's actually pretty much an inverse relationship between density of gun ownership, the rate of gun ownership in any given area, and the rate of murder. Now, you might find that a puzzler, but it's pretty clear and apparent why that would be. You notice that Ron didn't talk about Utah's high murder rates relative to the rest of the nation or other places, though he says we're not a very safe place to live. The reason for that is because in Western states, and indeed this is true in Canada, and it is even true in Western Europe, you will find that in rural areas, gun ownership is much higher as a percentage matter. One also might argue that the necessity for gun ownership is greater in rural areas because there's less availability of law enforcement and the like. But in any event, gun ownership rates are much, much higher in rural areas. Of course, murder rates are much, much higher in urban areas. And gun ownership rates are tremendously lower than in those rural areas. You can do this on a country kind of basis as well. For example, in Switzerland, where they still have a mandatory militia, that was practically what was one of the underlying assumptions of our own Second Amendment, was the continuation of a militia system as a primary means of defense. Almost every household has weapons because there's a mandatory militia system in virtually every adult male, at least. I don't know whether they've extended that to females or not, are required to have weapons in connection with their militia service, yet they have one of the lower murder rates in the world. Contrast that with Russia, where both in the former Soviet Union and in the current Russia, the ordinary citizen finds it almost impossible to get a gun. They went so far as to create their own separate caliber of bullets so that if you went out and found a black market handgun from the West, you would soon run out of bullets in all likelihood and have difficulty using it because the ammo in Russia and the former Soviet Union are so different. It's difficult to compare Russia because the old Soviet Union didn't keep good crime rates. But as I understand it, the scholars who have looked into this stuff seem to think that violent crime rates, in contrast to nonviolent crime rates, in the old Soviet Union were comparable to the West as a general matter. The current situation in Russia, the murder rates, despite the fact that the ordinary Russian citizen has almost no means of obtaining a firearm, given the level of expense that they cost on the black market, and therefore are essentially defenseless, their murder rate in the last several years has absolutely gone through the ceiling. Now, the reason for this is obvious. Switzerland has a very homogeneous population, a stable political system, an economic system that takes care of its people, and so forth and so on. There's lots of reasons to think that responsible gun ownership doesn't produce a lot of violence, and of course it doesn't. Russia, on the other hand, is a system in chaos, and an awful lot of the murders are basically hits done by friendly former members of the KGB, in most cases, who are enforcing the demands of local mob organizations. The evidence with respect to the nature of murderers tends to conform to what comes out of this kind of data. That is to say that if you look at murderers, and indeed to a large degree if you look at murder victims, you'll come to find that, particularly in the case of murderers, there's a long history of criminal behavior, usually long records, and usually a history of violent behavior in the past. In addition, if you look at risks of being subject to violent crime and to murder, I can simply recommend to you that if you would stay out of gangs and stay out of the drug business, you're going to do better. You could probably afford not to go deer hunting and be reasonably safe. The point is that it appears in many respects that it is a criminal industry, particularly with respect to a drug-related industry, that generates the need and the desirability in many quarters for having guns for illicit purposes, as opposed to guns producing the crime. It really appears as though the movement is in the other direction. If Utah is having a growing problem with violent crime, I think you might find that the keys to all of this lies in urbanization, the growth of a gang and drug culture, and other factors, much more so than gun ownership rates, which probably have stayed constant over 100 years. Finally, with respect to this basic issue, gun carry laws that have passed the last decade, and Ron was very critical of the fact that Utah passed one of these laws, but it's important to realize that more than half the states have passed liberalized gun carry laws. There's a couple of reasons for this. I mean, one of them is that the prior laws were administered in an extremely arbitrary way, and very often it came down to you got a permit to carry a gun if you were among the rich and famous, okay? So that, for example, Dianne Feinstein, who has always been a very strong proponent of expansive gun regulations and a very strong opponent of the gun culture, was one of the people who obtained, and it was a very small number of people, who obtained a permit to have a concealed firearm, because at a time she obtained that back in the 70s after a colleague of hers had been killed, and she had some reasons to be fearful. Not critical of her right to have a gun. What I am critical of is a certain kind of hypocrisy that basically says, when me and my friends, who I really know and trust, need guns, we really want you to get them for us, but when the unwashed masses want them, I've got a real problem with that. In any event, there's been a big debate about those laws. On the one side, everybody said, you're going to have all these people out there with new guns, carrying them now, not just having in their homes, with these liberalized carry laws, and that's going to produce more violence. We're going to have a bloodbath out there. People on the other side were saying, looking at the kind of data that I've just talked about, we're basically saying, no, you don't understand. We're talking about a system of deterrence here. What we need is more law-abiding citizens out there as veritable deputies, as it were, in the old-fashioned posse comitatus spirit, acting as a deterrent against people who are misusing guns. Now, does that work? Or which side got the better of the argument? It's difficult to say at this point. Most of these laws are under 10 years old, and the debate goes on. It is striking, however, and interesting that Florida, which was one of the earliest states to pass such a law, is the very place where they had a problem with people being attacked as they left the airport. And one of the steps they took to deal with that problem was to do away with markings on the automobiles that made it very clear that these were rental cars leaving the airport. Why would they be striking rental cars leaving the airport? Well, it's because criminals aren't stupid. Anybody else in Florida, you decide you want to bump and attack, you may have a problem. Somebody coming in from out of the country, you can rest pretty assured they won't have a firearm. Are criminals aware of such things? A lot of data, including polling information, suggests that they're very aware of them. But the most striking thing about what has happened is that almost no one believes that the passage of these laws and the years that we have labored under them in a number of different states, including very populated states like Florida, has actually led to serious increases in violent crime. As a matter of fact, there's a friend of mine who teaches law at Northwestern University Law School who has done a lot of research on these issues, Dan Paulsby. And I was chatting with Dan a week or two ago, and he told me that in all the research he has done, he has kept trying to find a single example of an ordinary citizen who went and got a permit to carry a gun who had been charged and convicted of a violent crime in the abuse of that gun permit. And what he basically found is that up until now, he's not been able to find an example. If any of you find one, write to him, care of Northwestern University Law School. But the point I'm getting at is that should not surprise us greatly. Because if you really stop and think about in terms of who is it that is most likely to misuse a gun, it's not going to take you very long to figure out that that's the last person who's going to go and register that gun with the police and obtain a permit for which to carry it. The people most likely to abuse guns are the people, by and large, who are the ones who are going to buy it somewhere else in a context not even from an authorized dealer as a means of avoiding it being traced to them further down the road. A related question that I'll just touch on very briefly before I wind up is the whole question of the effectiveness of gun regulations. If there's anything that seems moderately clear to me, it is that if we have a scandal in this country about violence and even about armed violence, it is extremely unlikely that the Brady Bill or an assault weapons ban, which, by the way, the biggest problem with assault weapon bans is one that Ron didn't mention at all, which is that there's not yet been an assault weapons ban passed that doesn't essentially ban a bunch of weapons that are absolutely identical to a whole bunch of other weapons that are other than in pure stylistics that are still otherwise going to be available, so that it seems like a kind of an empty gesture. And I think the biggest question about gun control laws in this country, as a general proposition, whatever their merits, and there are plenty of people around who, in fact, believe in gun rights and who also believe that they do need to be balanced against reasonable legislation. But whether most of the kinds of measures we want to take to try to prevent the abuse of firearms are likely to prevent increasing murder rates in a drug-infected culture, in a culture, where we live in these urban centers with all of the things that produce the violent crime that we have, seems like a very dubious proposition. And in fact, if we went further, as Ron does not appear to propose, and actually attempted to ban the ownership and possession of firearms, I think we would find, as we have with prohibition, as we have with the drug war, that we would wind up fighting basically a losing battle. If the lack of guns has any relationship to murder rates in terms of producing cultures related to violence or not, and I'm not at all certain whether they do or don't, it doesn't seem to me to be something we're going to solve through legislation. That's just the predominant thought. Now, just one final comment relating to, I guess, maybe the underlying spiritual kind of question. I confess that I've always had mixed feelings about this debate because I'm really a deep skeptic of gun control laws, and I actually have a good deal of respect for the underlying themes that I read in the concerns of the founding generation with respect to private versus governmental power. And so I take very seriously the question of gun rights. On the other hand, as a spiritual matter, I tend to resonate very nicely to the words in the Tao Te Ching, which say, "There is no greater illusion than fear, no greater wrong than preparing to defend yourself, no greater misfortune than than having an enemy, and whoever can see through all fear will always be safe." I guess that's my personal philosophy, and that's one of the reasons I don't have a gun, is because I really, as a spiritual, as an intuitive matter, feel very uncomfortable with the idea of carrying around a gun. And in Ron's question, I think, how would Jesus feel about us carrying around a gun prepared to use it all the time? And I think about somebody like Mr. Goetz, with whom a friend of mine and I debate about all the time, the New York subway shooter, who I think represents this kind of over-vigilance. But I have to confess to you all that as I have pondered and reflected on this for a year or two now, as I've studied the Second Amendment and related subjects, the counter thinking that has come into my own mind is the thought that we do live at the same time in a very difficult and tragic world. And even if my own spiritual sense moves in one direction, I find myself having a difficult time judging morally the people who perceive a somewhat different reality out there. I'm kind of reminded, in a way, as I think about someone owning a grocery store in certain inner-city neighborhoods in this country, or any number of other scenarios that come into my mind very readily. Someone living in L.A. immediately in the aftermath of the riots, where gun sales went through the roof, believe me. I find myself, thinking about a poster that I had on my door in my room. I was showing where my room was. We're staying with my folks. We're here from out of town to my own son. And he was asking me, as a matter of fact, what posters I had. And I remembered the one that said, it had a big-looking guy with a club. And he said, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for I am the meanest son of a bitch in the valley."
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, I remember there was a Western, and I, you know, forgive me, I didn't look it up, I don't remember the name of it, but there was a guy, you know, who had killed a number of people and had gone through a lot of remorse about all this, and he'd given up his guns, and the whole movie is bringing about this time when he's got to take that damn gun out and shoot it again, and nobody's going to let him off the hook, and he eventually, if I recall, gets around to doing that, like one more time to, you know, save the town or something. I guess what this all sort of points up to me is this difficult problem of living in a you know, sin-filled, tragic world in which there is a great deal of violence, and then you start contemplating what it would mean to have the life of your family members threatened, for example, and if you saw that as a threat. And it occurred to me that even at a spiritual level, it may be possible. You know, I always pondered, what did Jesus mean when he said, "Take no thought for the morrow"? And I used to know some people in the 70s who really thought that meant that you took LSD all night and enjoyed everything, and then somehow or another, everything was just going to happen for you. Maybe that's what it means, but I've always sort of suspected that what it really means is that we plan and prepare, but we don't live in tomorrow. And there may be an analogy here, it seems to me. I have a brother-in-law who lives in Richfield, Utah.
Excuse me, I would like a little time to respond.
I'm sorry. Let me wind this up then. I've got a brother-in-law who lives in Richfield, Utah, who has a couple of kids, and I've sent a couple of my kids out there to spend a summer with him. And I don't know a gentler individual in the world, and he served in Vietnam, and he's a member of the National Guard, and he owns firearms. I don't think he has a permit to carry at this point. But I can tell you with tremendous confidence that that if Jim had a permit to carry, I would view him with infinitely greater than any law enforcement official I've ever known. And I would expect that he would carry it with a sense of equanimity and peace, because I know him to be that kind of an individual, and who would act only under the most strict necessities, and would do it with a spiritual tone, not of, you know, of great defensive preparation, but simply of relaxed preparation for a potential eventuality. So I think that there may be more room here for reconciliation of these kinds of competing concerns than we sometimes admit. Thank you.
I'd just like to take a moment to respond to some of the concealed weapon bearer. Now, this is your brother or brother-in-law that you were referring to?
That lives in Richfield. Brother-in-law, yeah.
Brother-in-law, okay. We make laws for the weakest among us. 10% of the population has some sort of mental problem. We can assume that 10% of the police force, that you're going to have men in the police force that might have a mental problem. And I think we could assume the same thing is true of people who get a concealed weapons permit. And I think that's very dangerous. The police have constant training, day after day after day. And they have politicians looking over their shoulders. So I think the concealed weapons law is a gross violation of the social contract. We should all carry concealed weapons, or none of us should. And if none of us should, then we ought to demand a police force that is trustworthy. And if we can't have that, then we have a societal breakdown. But that's a social contract. It's always been that way. Switzerland, I lived in Switzerland. I know a lot about Switzerland. And Switzerland is not a militia. That is the army, and the people carry their guns home, and they are the best trained military in the world, has nothing to do with a sloppy, a casual kind of militia. In 1953, when I was in Switzerland, they did have a real problem because people were taking hand grenades home, and little kids were pulling the pins, and they were blowing up the house. So that was a common problem, and they solved it with the rule that you don't take the damn hand grenade home. And what we're talking about simply is, let's get some common sense rules. And I am angry because the gun people aren't setting the rules. They do not worry about procedures. All they are concerned about is their rights. Now, we don't hear anything now about canceling gun safety training for young deer hunters, because it's a proven case that we saved a lot of lives. And gun control laws save lives. And I think the best, you say, well, it's inconclusive. Well, let's look at Canada. Canada would never go back or never accept the kind of laws that we have. And they have a very safe society with a lot of hunters, with a lot of marksmen, and with a lot of gun collectors. I'll bet there are as many guns in Canada as there are in the United States per capita. But they have it organized, and it's the kind of guns they have. And all I'm saying is just common sense. I don't care about the Second Amendment. We do not have a right to kill 38,000 people a year. I mean, if that's what we're doing to celebrate the Second Amendment, anyway, I think people do have a right to have a gun, and I think they have a responsibility to do it right. And I think that ends the argument there. I mean, I don't want to discuss the Second Amendment. That isn't what this is all about. And I think the other point is that it is a moral issue. It's a public health issue. We didn't talk about the public health issue. And we kill a lot of kids in this country. And that's not happening in other countries.
Better education. I mean, I think that, maybe really, now, how do you do it? I think today, how do we get country? How do we open this thing up so we get more rational?
I think there's got to be open dialogue, but I think I also said that I thought the church should make a statement and tell people to start thinking about it, and that it is a moral issue, that there is a moment that you've got to either, you know, shoot first and ask questions later. That's a terrible, terrible situation to be in, and yet that's what they tell the people who take training for carrying a concealed weapon, that it will be used against you if you don't move first. Question, Mike.
The comments that you made about the politics involved, if you follow the Utah legislature at all, you know, in the past couple of sessions when they tried to get even, and this is responsible gun ownership, just the clips on the guns, you know, when you sold the gun, you sold the clip with it, would not even get onto the floor of the legislature to be discussed. The other issues of making penalties for people who own the guns, who then that gun is involved in an accident, children shooting each other, children shooting somebody else, but the parent or the party who owned the gun to be held legally responsible could not even be discussed. Now, that is responsible gun ownership. It says nothing that you cannot own a gun, but it says if you own that gun, you must be responsible for it. And we can't even discuss those kind of issues that have nothing to do with the Second Amendment or taking guns away, but just saying that you are going to be a gun owner, then you would be liable, you would be responsible for that gun, and here in Utah, we cannot even get those kind of laws down.
Thank you.
Just a note on gun safety, which is that gun-related accidents have gone dramatically downhill over the last two or three decades, and that has happened in part with various kinds of measures that have been taken and have been supported by the National Rifle Association, and they have never been an opponent of gun safety laws, as far as I know,
gun hunting.
No, as a prerequisite to getting a license, they absolutely favor it. For example, the Utah law that you I mean, if they had opposed it, I suspect you would have been noting that. I'm pretty confident they would not have.
Well,
they never have.
Pre-1972 radical NRA.
Well,
that's changed completely. That's a totally. But let me just finish.
The characterization of the NRA is a very partisan one.
Let me just state that the American Baptist Churches, the America's Jewish Conference, the Central Conference of American Rabbis, the Church of the Brethren, the Church Women United, the Episcopal Church, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, Disciples of Christ, Friends Committee on National Legislation, Jesuit Conference, Mennonite Central Committee, National Council of Churches, National Council of Jewish Women, Presbyterian Church, Union of American Hebrew Congregations, Unitarian Universalists, United Church of Christ, United Methodist Church, United States Catholic Conference, Young Women's Christian Association, all have taken very strong positions on the moral issue of guns, and that there ought to be gun legislation to reduce the amount of scandalous killing. Nobody has any answer for the killing, we haven't tried gun control in this country. We hear people say gun control doesn't work. We've never tried it. They've tried it in Canada, it works. They tried it in England, it works. They tried it in Switzerland, and it works too, because that is gun control.
If any of you know any gun owners, you might want to ask them if they think there's any gun control in this country. It's one of our most heavily regulated issues.
Thank you very much.
The cities of Canada, you guys have been...